This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 5th, 2012. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhulkar. In just a moment, a report from Rogers about the latest development that has emerged from a collaborative partnership of Mercy Health System of Northwest Arkansas and the Northwest Arkansas Family YMCA. And our history doctor also uses the Occupy movement as a launching pad for discussion about larger protest movements in the past.
And after a holiday break, our two regular Thursday contributors, Jody Beznoska from Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville and Michael Tilley from thecitywire.com, will be back.
But first, earlier this morning, the Northwest Arkansas Mercy Family YMCA hosted a grand opening celebration and ribbon cutting at the new facility, which is located at Village on the Creeks in Rogers. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended the event and spoke with the CEO of Northwest Arkansas Family YMCA, Jenny Hoewaker. She told Antoinette how the YMCA and Mercy Health Systems began their partnership.
We have a mutual board member staff person. Dee Bowers really was instrumental in bringing the two organizations together. She's a Mercy staff person and she's a YMCA board member. And she just was sitting in meetings for Mercy and sitting in meetings for the Y and hearing the same vision and the same needs and really brought the two organizations together so that we could form a partnership and move along on the same path.
So how long has this partnership been in the works?
This partnership's been in the works for well over, probably about a year and a half. We've been working together, trying to find, both establish the partnership and how it would all function, as well as find the location that was going to be best for all of us to be able to serve the community.
And today we've had the ribbon cutting and the grand opening ceremony. So how do you feel to finally have this big day?
It's a big day. we've been looking forward to the grand opening. We actually opened the doors December 1st quietly because we saw a few things we needed to do, and it's a continuing work in progress as we go along. We develop with the community and what the community wants and needs. So as we find those gaps that still need to be filled, there'll be even more transformation along the line. So
how did you come to find this location here at Village on the Creeks in Rogers?
Well, a couple things came into play. Mercy has a lot of offices in this area. They are, predominantly the foundation's located here, the Max store is located here. And so when the property became available, we started talking about this location. And it took us well over a year to finally get to the point that this was a real possibility. And, with Mercy's presence in the area and the location it is, right off 540 and centrally located in the Northwest Arkansas area, we really thought it was very beneficial to be here.
What are some of the services that the YMCA will be able to provide to the Northwest Arkansas region?
Sure. The YMCA focuses on youth development, healthy living, and social responsibility. So within those three areas, we're looking at after-school programming, we're looking at preschool, hopefully early this year still, and we offer, services for families with the Child Watch, and we have an itty-bitty basketball program coming up for preschoolers in February. With our healthy living, we offer different fitness classes, but we offer some long-term options as well. Our Back on Track program that starts Monday night is a 13-week health and wellness program that focuses on physical activity and nutrition. We offer a couch potato to 5K class that gets people off the couch and gets them moving to complete a 5K in 10 weeks. So there's some of those long-term health classes to get you on the right path. And then with our social responsibility, we're looking at what things can we do in Northwest Arkansas to really reach out and improve community and strengthen community. And, we're looking at a partnership with the Children's Center to be able to offer those kids programming on site where they're at to build self-esteem and self-confidence. We're looking at different volunteer opportunities we have both with the Y and out in the community and building those volunteer forces for our area to make the community stronger as well.
And you mentioned 5K. You guys actually have a 5K fundraiser next week, right?
We have a Tucks on the Run 5K, our annual 5K coming up on Saturday at 10 a.m., and we're really excited about that because we actually have a home to run from this time. You know, this is the first year we'll have a facility to come inside to afterwards, you know, when it's a little chilly out in January on our 5K. So we'll be able to do our refreshments and rewards on the inside this year. But yes, that'll be coming up on Saturday. It usually has a really good response from the community, and it should be a really fun time.
And that's next Saturday?
Saturday the 14th, yep.
And do you actually dress in a tuxedo?
No, there was a time we did a little bit more costuming with it and stuff, but really it's just our mascot for the race is a penguin, and so he'll be, you know, we'll be have our penguin signs out, it'll be chilly, and so that's where the Tux on the Run comes from.
I like it. If people want any more information about the YMCA or the fundraiser coming up or how to sign up, things like that, where can they get information?
They can call the Y. It's 479-273-9622. Or they can visit our website as well. There's lots of information on our website, which is www.ymcanwa.org.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talked with Jenny Holweger, the CEO of the Northwest Arkansas Family YMCA, earlier this morning at the ribbon cutting and grand opening of that new facility in Rogers. This is Ozarks at Large. And this is a Thursday, January 5th, 2012 edition of Ozarks at Large. After a couple of weeks away from our conversations, I welcome back Michael Tilley, who's in his office in Fort Smith. He is the editor, publisher, owner, and a lot of other things at thecitywire.com, which covers business, politics, and more for the Fort Smith region. How is your 2012 so far, Mr. Tilley?
It was great. It was great so far. It is great so far, and hopefully it'll be great about 11 or 11:30 Friday night. After the Cotton Bowl.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Well, many of the things that we talked about in 2011, we're still talking about in 2012. And let me begin with Whirlpool. They have had a complaint from a union filed against them.
Yes, and I'll have an update on that story later today on the City Wire. But you know, Whirlpool announced back in October, late October, they're going to close their Fort Smith plant. And they began severance benefit programs and these and other things to start cycling employees out as they reduce production. Well, the union is alleging that Whirlpool is doing this outside the terms of their labor contract. And indeed, the existing labor contract still holds, but you know, Whirlpool is not backing away. They're essentially saying, look, you know, these employees have no reasonable expectation of recall. I mean, we're shutting this down. So they just sent them severance benefits, and under the terms of the contract, all severance benefits are supposed to be negotiated between the union and the company, and Whirlpool has just negotiated them by themselves and sent them a check. So that complaint has been filed with the National Labor Relations Board, and it could be about mid-February before that board rules on whether the allegation has any merit.
Another topic that we talked about in late 2011 was a conversation between a couple of cities over water and a true-up deal.
Right. It looks like there are roughly $253,000 at stake. And the long story short is that Fort Smith maintained that Van Buren owed another $253,000 for 2009 water charges. Van Buren said that Fort Smith waited too late to send them the bill, essentially. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's essentially the bottom line, and refused to pay it. And some of the board members, the Fort Smith City board members, wanted to keep pressing Van Buren to pay. And Fort Smith, however, has received two legal opinions, one from their own city attorney and one from an outside attorney who said, Fort Smith wants to take this to a legal fight, Fort Smith will lose, and Van Buren will win. So I think the board has just said, okay, we made a mistake. We didn't, you know, effectively push for the 253,000, so we're just going to live and learn and move on. It's still a bitter pill for some residents in Fort Smith, but yet others think, well, if we're going to try to play nice, we shouldn't be taking each other to court. But it looks like it's over, and they're just going to move on now.
And it was Tuesday night that the board of directors unanimously did something that was no surprise, but they're going to ask voters in Fort Smith in March to extend a 1% sales tax that will the city plans to spend on a number of different municipal needs.
Right, yeah, fresh off the heels of their drubbing on the 1% prepared food tax, they put another tax on the ballot. However, Kyle, I don't see this one being that controversial, except possibly for that there's a portion of the tax that would support some parks projects, and it will be interesting. I haven't seen that much opposition gen up, and the portion of the tax that supports the water bonds and the water system improvements have been in the past just overwhelmingly, 70-80% votes. So I see that being passed, but on the election, each item has to be voted for. So it'll be interesting to see what the breakdown is on that ballot.
That's right. So it is not a just vote for the continued 1%. You will have an a la carte on the ballot.
That's correct. Yeah, and I don't know if the city's going to push for the campaign. Frankly, they did just a horrible job lobbying for the 1% prepared food tax. So I don't know how aggressively they're going to pursue the parks projects, but it's a joint project with the county, Sebastian County, to build some ball fields and an aquatics park at Ben Guerin Regional Park. Just hang on. So, here we go, another interesting tax election in a highly charged presidential election year, no less.
And new jobless numbers for the metro areas in Arkansas were released for November 2011, and they dropped in just about every metro area. Fort Smith from October 2011 to November 2011, a slight drop from 7.9% unemployment to 7.8%, in Northwest Arkansas from 5.9% to 5.5%.
Right, and Northwest Arkansas continues to have the lowest unemployment rate of the metro areas in Arkansas. But again, Kyle, we often talk about these economic numbers, about the good news, bad news element. And the good news, obviously, is that rate is coming down. Unfortunately, the number of people measured in the workforce is also falling. And in some instances, the number of employed is decreasing, even though the jobless rate is decreasing. It's counterintuitive that when you have, several thousand people leave the workforce or no longer counted for whatever reason, it can lower your jobless rate even if you have fewer people employed in your metro area. So that's what we're seeing with several of the metro areas, including the Fort Smith region.
I also want to ask you about Arkansas-based stocks in 2011. If I had put all of my money from my retirement into Arkansas-based stocks, I probably wouldn't have seen a gain.
It depends on where you invested. For example, if you invested with Bentonville-based Carmark, or Dillard's even, mm-hmm. or J.B. Hunt, or Tyson Foods, you would have seen some gains. And with Tyson, you would have seen a healthy gain. In fact, they were one of the big gainers of the year. Their shares were up roughly a little over 25% for the year. So you would have been doing well there. But overall, the 15 stocks that are the 15 companies that are based in Arkansas that are publicly held, they didn't. Just seven of those saw gains in 2011. The overall market didn't do that well either. So it's not that they performed worse than the market. It was just a down year, and that's not news to anyone.
And finally, thecitywire.com continues to grow. You've added another person.
Yes, sir. And thanks for letting me mention. We're going to bring on Kim Souza sometime in mid January. She's well known in your part of the world. Been covering business from the Morning News and now for the Democrat Gazette for 6-7 years. She's followed Tyson and the banking community and the real estate industry. I mean, she is a well respected and hardworking journalist. And we're very pleased that she's on board with us.
All right, Michael, thank you very much. Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers business, politics, culture, and much more for the Fort Smith region and beyond. Have a great weekend, and go Hogs.
Yes, sir. Go hog.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, January 5th. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, the latest sunrises of the year might be happening for you around now.
The exact date of latest sunrise varies with latitude, but they're happening now for latitudes like those across the central United States. Likewise, comparable latitudes in the Southern Hemisphere are seeing the latest sunsets of the year around now. That might surprise you because the shortest or longest day of the year always comes on a solstice, and the most recent solstice was in December.
But it's a seasonal phenomenon that the latest sunrises and sunsets don't coincide with the shortest or longest day. The main reason is that our Earth doesn't stand exactly upright with respect to its orbit around the sun. A secondary reason is that the Earth's orbit isn't a perfect circle.
Earth is always traveling fastest in orbit when we're nearest the sun every January. We're always traveling slowest in orbit when we're farthest from the sun in July. Clock time gets a bit out of sync with sun time by about half a minute a day for several weeks around the December solstice.
The result is latest and earliest sunrises and sunsets that are out of sync with the solstices. It sounds complicated, but many people notice it. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Dr. Bill Smith, our history doctor. Today, well, you probably are aware of Occupy Wall Street, a series of protests around the country that has caught the attention of the nation. In Northwest Arkansas, there has been Occupy Northwest Arkansas. There's been Occupy Little Rock. We have seen these Occupy fill-in-the-blank all over the country, and many people are making comparisons to the 1960s. Dr. Bill Smith, is that accurate?
Yes and no. The answer that I'm sure you were expecting.
Yes, it is.
You know, let's make some quick and clear distinctions. The Occupy Wall Street movement seems to be economically focused in its politics. It's a mistake to confuse their work with the anti-war and civil rights events of the 1960s. The protests at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, for example, had some economic base, but that wasn't its core. Of course, the huge race riots that burned large swaths of American cities, again, bad examples to try to say this movement is like those movements of the 60s.
All right, so we have that defined. What's the comparison?
Well, I think we have a little bit of a comparison. In one of the great movements of the 60s was the SDS. You've probably heard the letters, Students for Democratic Society. It was born from the Port Huron movement. 1962, meeting of some individuals to decide a manifesto of sorts of how they wish to proceed in changing America's politics. Now, SDS is going to peak in the late 60s, and in large part, it was a protest movement known for sit-ins, or more accurately, teach-ins, during 65, 66, and 67. They focused mostly on college campus events. 67, 68, they began to protest against some corporate entities associated with what was becoming known as the military-industrial complex and the Vietnam War. Of course, there was the splinter group that was far more violent that broke off from SDS that became known as Weathermen. Now, aside from the Cold War aspects, which really the Port Huron statement was more focused on, it shared some common points. But still, that was not the economic focus that you see in today's protest. Better examples of this might be the Hoovervilles of the 30s, or maybe the Hobos before that, or even back into the latter part of the 1800s and some of the labor movements in there.
The Occupy movement, in early stages, what's next?
Well, remember, I mentioned 1962 was the Port Huron Statement. It's not till 65 that you see some larger protests, and 68 and 69 for the more violent and large-scale events. I think your question now is flashover. The movement began in the early 60s and featured small occupations of educational facilities, you know, not unlike what's happening now, with a focus on economically-oriented facilities like Wall Street. But it was the free speech movement in Berkeley that saw one of the first violent clashes couple thousand folks held a sit-down around a block to prevent the arrest of one of their colleagues, and that shut the town down for a day. It escalates from there. I think this is a point that needs to be clearly made. While Occupy Wall Street is getting a lot of attention, it is nothing in the scale to what was going on during the late 60s. What started off as tens of thousands involved would eventually peak out in 1968 with a national student strike day in which roughly a million were reported to have not gone to class that day, shutting down several schools and taking over the campus of Columbia University during that time. I mean, when I say take over the campus, I mean not a building, not the administrative building, the campus.
So Occupy right now can be classified as a relatively small movement compared to those.
Well, and again, really quiet and frankly, in spite of what you may have seen on TV, well-behaved. What many remember is the days of rage when you think back to student movements in the late 60s, the Weathermen, the race riots. So to put it in context, what you're seeing now, you know, with the exception of that violent breakoff group from SDS, is not a really good analogy, nor are some of the other events like Haymarket riot and events during the 30s, although you get a little bit of a crossover there. One of the first things that Weatherman set off a bomb on was the statue to the police that had been killed during the Haymarket riot.
Haymarket in the latter quarter of the 19th century. How do these recent events stand up to that?
Well, Haymarket Square was the site of one of the largest early labor protests, and it erupted into a violent event when an anarchist put a bomb into the crowd, and this started the police firing, and eight were killed. No one really knew who shot who or even who threw the bomb. It was the outgrowth of a May 1st, 1886 event nationwide, which set the tone. So you could say there's some analogy there. And this was a labor movement drawing attention to the growing need for organized labor. In May the 3rd, there had been an organizing event near the McCormick plant, which was outside of Chicago. On May the 4th, a rally at Haymarket Square in Chicago. That is the heart of the event. Started off as your usual kind of protest, speeches. The mayor reportedly had come out to look to see what was going on. Nobody thought much of it until the bomb went off. You know, the event literally gives us the phrase, bomb-throwing anarchist, if you've heard that tossed about before. Many will also say this is the original police riot of Chicago, you know, as in 86, in 68, 1968, you had the great demonstration outside the Democratic National Convention in which the police went off and you had the famous phrase of the whole world is watching as the protesters were clubbed and hauled away. So Haymarket really is not a settled event. It tarnishes the labor movement for some time after 1886 and labels them as radical and tars them with the anarchist brush. At the same time, it inspired International May Day and gave some focus and movement to that political side of the aisle. To this day, though, we really don't know how it started. We just know the tragedy that resulted.
It was based in labor. Jobs obviously relate to labor. Are there any specific prior events to needing work?
Well, economic disruption has led to many protest events during our history, but the widest spread and longest lasting were the encampments of homeless and jobless that started in 1929 and in some areas lasted until the start of the Second World War that were a result of the upheaval we know as the Great Depression. They grew in almost every major city, and they became the center of some protest, but they mostly were about survival. It is where people lived in tents and shanties and tried to get by where they had lost a house, lost a job, lost the ability to take care of themselves. These areas were periodically cleared out by civic leaders or attempted to be cleared out by civic leaders, and they gained the generic label of Hoovervilles, named for the president at the time, of course, Herbert Hoover.
And many of these had a strong presence of veterans, people who had fought in the First World War.
They did, and one of the most notable of those was the Bonus Army. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great confrontations of this period. The Bonus Army was a protest of tens of thousands of World War I veterans. During the flush money times of the early 20s, Congress had voted a pension of sorts, a bonus, to veterans of the First World War, not unlike the billion-dollar Congress had voted a pension to the veterans of the Grand Old Army, the Union War veterans, in the 1880s when things were flush, then had a hard time paying that off.
There is a cycle here, isn't there?
It does.
When times are great, we'll promise you money.
We love to spend money, and then when times get tough.
Sorry.
We meant to. Why? We absolutely did. Now, that said on this one, mm-hmm. what the bonus had promised was a payoff in 1945. Mm. It is 1932. And these veterans have marched on Washington to protest and to raise their voice and say, you know what, Congress, we'd like our bonus right now.
Times are tough.
And this is what the vote was about and the protest was about. And Congress rejected, overwhelmingly rejected, the Bonus Army bill to change the date of the payout. Now what's going to happen? In Anacostia Flats outside of Washington, D.C., was one of the larger Hoovervilles to begin with, and now it is flush with over 10,000 veterans. Kind of a scary thought if you're the federal government that right on the edge of town are former military who could perhaps organize themselves again and this time not come in protest, but perhaps do more damage.
Oh, and by the way, who did give years and blood and sweat to defend the country.
Exactly. And are without job, without a place to go, and somewhat desperate. So you've got men who are in a position that could be a threat to you, or at least this is the way they become perceived. Mm-hmm. Herbert Hoover will call on the veterans to disperse. And when by that date they did not disperse, the Attorney General of the United States ordered the forcible removal of the Bonus Army and the routing out of the Hoovervilles and Anacostia Flats. This is the first re-emergence on the national scene of the famous Army family of the MacArthurs. Mm-hmm. Douglas MacArthur will command the infantry sent in to rout the protesters, and he will be supported by a tank brigade led by none other than Major George Patton. There were reports of the use of gas on the veterans, and I don't mean gasoline, although that did come into play later when they burned the camp. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about chemical warfare, essentially, lobbing in gas grenades. The infantry routed the Bonus Army with fixed bayonet charges. You can sort of get a sense of what this was. Could you imagine now, as we often like to talk about, in a 24/7 cycle.
Oh, my gosh. The current United States military in battle with veterans of that same military?
Indeed.
It is not one of the prouder moments in the country's history.
Many were injured, a few were killed, and the Army eventually set fire to the camp so that there would be no return to the Anacostia Flats, Hoovervilles.
I want to go back to a term you said earlier when we were first talking, and you mentioned Hoovervilles and some others. You mentioned hobos.
Right. And most folks are acquainted with the idea of the hobo,
the cartoon character.
Yeah. Well, you know, in reality, it's a young man who is without means or job or rooted. Mm-hmm. So they would take to the rails looking for opportunity, looking for something to do and travel the country. Hobos had been around, and that term really is vague in its origin. It's going to appear after the start of the 1900s. But hobos have been around since there have been railroads. Obviously, when times got tough in the Great Depression, hobo and hobo culture explodes and becomes a major part of this. If you had lost your way and perhaps had a family and couldn't move from your area, you might have deposited yourself and your family in the Hoovervilles. But if you heard rumor that, hey, a few hundred miles down the railroad track there might be jobs, what you would do instead is you would hobo, jump the train, and hope for the best in some other part of the country.
All right. Well, until someone calls you a bomb-throwing anarchist,
we're history.
Mitt Romney won the Iowa caucus this week with just a quarter of the vote, meaning the GOP has given up trying to find somebody they love and is willing to settle. In the wedding portrait, Mitt is beaming, and the Republican Party is smiling, but not with its eyes. I'm Peter Sagal. Speaking of settling, join us this weekend for the News Quiz, Wait, Wait, from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. With the Arkansas Forestry Commission facing a budget shortfall and the pending layoffs of 36 employees later this month, the agency's head yesterday met with lawmakers at the state capitol. Director John Shannon is asking legislators to support the governor's plan to give the agency more than $2.5 million to help it get through the end of the fiscal year. Roby Brock with our content partner Talk Business covered that hearing.
I think that this whole agency issue is still very much up in the air. I think in late January we'll see a proposal from the governor for the supplemental appropriation. I don't think it's a slam dunk that they get that money, even though the money is there from the budget surplus. I think that you're going to see legislators continue to ask some pretty tough questions about the management of this agency and some of the spending decisions that they've made over the last couple of years. And is it being managed as properly or as well as it could be? I still think that John Shannon's going to face a pretty big firing squad from some legislators that are not satisfied with the answers they've received so far.
The Forestry Commission has blamed its shortfall on a decline in timber sales. Roby says there was a suggestion made for shoring up the decline.
I think lawmakers still have a lot of questions about the management of the Forestry Commission. I don't think they're satisfied that they've gotten a lot of answers to previous questions that they've asked about spending habits and spending decisions. That said, they still did ultimately turn their attention to the budget woes and the funding problems that the Forestry Commission is experiencing with the decline in the severance tax and the fact that they've had this double counting issue with federal grants that they've received. A couple of solutions that they discussed, obviously looking at what's causing the severance tax decline and is there any way to shore that up. Apparently the Forestry Commission actually owns some timber acreage in parts of South Arkansas. There was a suggestion that they may look at leasing or maybe selling some of that land to generate more revenue. And then they discussed a supplemental appropriation of about $2.7 million, which is going to get the agency to the end of this fiscal year at the end of June. But where it goes from there, I think, is still very much up in the air.
That's Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net.
State finance officials reported yesterday that Arkansas revenues came in above forecast last month. Deputy Director Tim Leathers says December revenues totaled $418 million last month, which is nearly 10% above the year before.
The best news in this is that all along our income tax withholding has been offsetting sales tax, and we've kind of been lagging in our sales tax, and this month we did actually slightly exceed the sales tax that we had projected.
But Leathers says that may be offset by upcoming tax refunds for individuals and corporations.
We're thinking that probably a lot of that we may give back in refunds as the fiscal year goes on for us. But it does put us up a total of $42 million for the year above forecast. So it kind of positions us well for the refund season that we'll be seeing here in the next few weeks.
Leather says part of the increase was thanks to a better-than-expected growth in sales tax collections.
Plenty of college basketball in the area tonight. The Arkansas Razorback women's basketball team will play the second SEC game of the season tonight in Lexington, Kentucky. And for the second time, it's against a nationally ranked team. Kentucky is ranked 11th in the latest Associated Press poll. Arkansas lost their SEC opener Sunday afternoon at number 16, Georgia. And this weekend, the Razorback women will make it three in a row against ranked opponents when they host number 6 Tennessee Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at Bud Walton Arena. Meanwhile, both UA Fort Smith basketball teams open conference play tonight at Oklahoma Panhandle State University. That's in Goodwill, Oklahoma. Both John Brown University basketball teams are home tonight, hosting Mid-American Christian. Those games in Siloam Springs, of course. And both University of the Ozarks teams will be at home in Clarksville tonight, hosting Mary Hardin Baylor.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large, the first Thursday of 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums, and we're going to start our Thursdays off in 2012 like we had them in 2011 with Jody Beznoska, who is the Vice President of Communications at Walton Heart Center.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome to 2012.
Yes. Do you have a good break?
I did have a great break.
All right.
It was lots of fun, very relaxing, and now we're ready to get back into the new year.
Now, you went to Florida, but you skipped before they had their record low temperatures this week. Yes.
I did. We had beautiful weather down in Florida, and I decided to come back here just in time to have some more beautiful weather.
There you go.
It was well-timed on my part.
And Walton Arts Center's had a break, but things are cranking up.
Yeah, we're coming back. We're getting ready for January. There's a lot going on and a lot of different kinds of shows in January, which is always fun. So tonight, we were just talking about Brian Regan, mm-hmm. the comedian, will be performing. His show is at 7:30. The show is sold out. Mm-hmm. But what we always say in this case is if you are really, really keen to see Brian Regan, you should try to come down and get on standby about an hour before the show. And if any tickets come available or if people turn them back in or something happens, we'll try to get you in. Okay. So that's about the best we can offer on a sold-out show like this. But again, that's tonight at 7:30. And then this Sunday at 2 o'clock, we will be at the Fayetteville Public Library.
We, as in you and I. Yes.
Yes. For the third in our 10 by 10 countdown conversation series. And so this is a new partnership with the library that we're doing where about 10 days before our 10 by 10 arts series shows, we have a conversation with some local folks who are, I guess I'll use the word expert on mm-hmm. some of the artists and music styles that are coming up on the 10 by 10 series. So I'm excited about this one because this is the first one that you'll be facilitating
yes.
for us.
Yes.
And we'll be talking with Fernando Valencia about the music of Pancho Sanchez and his band. They have a new album out, so I'm sure we'll be talking about mm-hmm. that. So that is Sunday. That's 2 o'clock at the public library, and that is free.
Yes. Just walk in.
Just come on in and join us. And so that is the 8th of January. On the 10th, which is Tuesday, the Blue Men Group will open their week with us. And this is the second time we've had the Blue Men here in the last, I don't know, 2 years. The tickets for Blue Men are going incredibly fast. So don't wait. Order them now. Either get online or call or come down to the box office. This is the show that we premiered here at Northwest Arkansas back in 2009. And it's going to be really fun. If you haven't seen the Blue Men, they're worth seeing. And they're really worth seeing in a theater like ours because it's a different experience than seeing them in a giant arena where they might just mm-hmm. be little blue figures, you know, way off right. in the distance. And it's a very well-designed show for a theater of our size. In fact, it was designed in our theater.
They spent much time here
refining
and defining.
They were here for about 6 weeks putting the show together. And like I said, our audiences were the first to see it. And then it went off on the road and it's been touring. It's been in the United States and Canada over the last, 18, 20 months, and now it's back. We're the first market to get it back. We're pretty excited about it. It's going to be a good time. And still tickets left, but like I said, they are going quickly. And that runs from Tuesday the 10th through Sunday the 15th. There are 8 performances. Matinee is on Saturday and Sunday. And then we will have a couple days off, and then we will have Pancho Sanchez and his mm-hmm. band at 8 p.m. on Friday, the 20th of January. Because that's on the 10 by 10 art series, that means the tickets are
$10. Right.
And there's a creative conversation prior to the show at 7 o'clock.
With Pancho?
We're not sure
okay.
yet. We're
okay.
hoping. We're crossing our fingers for that. And then the following evening, the 21st, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas will have their third concert of the season, their Masterworks concert. That's a 7:30 show. It will feature a rising piano star and a great deal of Russian classical composers. So very excited for that. That's on the 21st. On the 25th, Keb Mo will be here and his band. Mm-hmm. That's a 7 o'clock show. And then the following Saturday, the 28th, we'll have Lewis Black, the comedian, at 8 p.m.
And you told me those tickets were scarce.
They're very scarce at this point. Again, it's probably going to be a similar situation to Brian Regan, where we're going to have to get you on standby if you want to come out. But keep trying and calling the box office. Comedy is just really doing well.
That's great.
These days. It's fantastic. And then February. February is a very busy, the first weekend of February is very busy for us with 3 very different shows. We have the Mark Morris Dance Company on the 2nd.
Part of the 10 by 10.
Part of the 10 by 10 art series. Then we have the the trio Time for Three on the 3rd at 8 p.m.
Part of the 10 by 10.
Also part of 10 by 10. And then on the 4th, which is a Saturday, we have not talked about this show. It's almost like it's completely flying under the radar. We have a show called Intergalactic Nemesis, and it is a live-action graphic novel. So
I guess I didn't know live action graphic novels existed.
Neither
did
I.
This is very interesting.
It is very interesting. And we'll learn more about it and talk more about it as time goes on. But I'm really intrigued by this concept because, you know, graphic novels are so popular mm-hmm. with a younger crowd, but there are other folks who really
sure.
like it. And the idea of taking one and bringing it to life, it's a combination of multimedia, live performance. It feels like it could be a radio show at times.
Mm-hmm.
It's really going to be interesting.
And it is called?
The Intergalactic Nemesis.
Okay.
And so we'll investigate that a little bit more. But that is that's going to be a great show for families, especially if you have slightly older kids. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, 10 and up, this would be a good one for
okay.
them, especially if they're into comics and graphic novels. So that's on the 4th of February, 8 o'clock. And then Bring It On, the musical, will be here from the 7th through the 12th, a full week of that. And we're on the first national tour of this new musical that it opened in Los Angeles. And it is the story of competitive cheerleading. It's based on the movies, the popular mm-hmm. movies that a lot of people know. But it is not the same story as the movies.
It is not the same story.
No. Did you know there are 5 Bring It On movies?
I knew there were several because sometimes when you're going through Netflix and
yep.
you go, really?
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, think about it. If there are 5 Bring It On movies, it would be tough to make a musical that was exactly the movie.
Right.
So the concept of the movie is the same. It's about the world of competitive cheerleading.
Is it still like this super sort of privileged,
yes.
mostly white school
yes.
against this inner city school?
Yes.
And one steals from the other?
Well, it actually has a lot more.
Oh, you've seen it.
I've seen it.
I
saw it was when it was in it wasn't really workshops, but it was like its first run in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and I did see it. And it does have the same premise in that there is the privileged school and the not-so-privileged
mm-hmm.
school, and they compete for the state title or the national title in cheerleading. But it's very much about sort of friendship, connection. They compete, but it isn't really a huge rivalry.
Okay.
It's more like, you know, what can this – basically, the premise is the cheer captain from the privileged school
mm-hmm.
gets redistricted to the other
oh.
school. And she tries to bring that school along and teach them why cheer is important and why it's fun.
Okay.
And what I love about Bring It On is that there are actual cheerleaders on stage. And so they're doing real stunts like you would see in a cheer competition.
Do you know, will you have to do something different for the floor?
Our floor is a sprung theater,
yeah.
so it should be okay. I'm pretty sure they bring their own floor, though.
Their own mats or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, their own
okay.
mats and their own stuff because they, you know, it's very, very athletic. A lot of shows will have a fight call or a dance call before
mm-hmm.
the show begins where they practice the dance moves
right.
and stuff. This one has a stunt call
Oof.
Where they practice
wow.
the flips and the turns and all of that. And we also have a former student from Bentonville who is in the show.
No kidding.
Yeah. So
oh, that's great.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. So we're excited about Bring It On. There's some really neat things about being a part of the first tour of a new musical. So that brings us into February. Lots more going on later in February. Theater Squared will launch their new show, Tigers Be Still,
mm-hmm.
on the 9th. And we'll have another Broadway show with Million Dollar Quartet later in the month.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, that's going to be great. We hopefully by now we're starting to tell people that the guy who plays Elvis in the musical is an Arkansan.
Really?
He's from Harrison, I believe. His name is Cody Slaughter. And
how about that?
Yeah, and so we're going to have an Arkansan in the national touring show, which
that's
is great.
Great.
Yeah,
oh.
So lots going on, and you can get tickets at waltonartscenter.org, or you can call us at 443-5600, or you can come down and visit us and stop by the box office. Parking is free until 2 o'clock.
Sunday would have been Elvis's 77th birthday, by
that's
the way.
That's right. Yeah. Also my brother's birthday.
But not 77.
No, not 77, okay. Happily.
Jody, thank you.
Thanks, Kyle.
This week on This American Life, Mike Daisy was on an Apple computer fan site. I read about a guy who bought an iPhone, and it wasn't blank.
It had information on it from inside the factory. And in fact, in the camera roll, there were pictures on it from inside the factory.
Mike stared at those pictures, then flew to China to stand outside the factory gates and meet these workers.
This American Life, Saturday morning at 6, Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF.
And it's time for our giveaway question now.
Yes, we're going to give away two tickets to Malco Theater, any Malco Theater in the listening area.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we've got one more Tim Ernst 2012 calendar. Not too late to start using that. And one last CD from the Fort Smith Symphony.
Okay.
William Grant Steele Music Afro-American Symphony. All right.
Okay. So the question is, related to tomorrow's Cotton Bowl game.
Yes, football game.
Mm-hmm.
For years played in the actual Cotton Bowl in Dallas. Now it's in the Cowboy Stadium in Arlington.
Mm-hmm. And now the first ever Cotton Bowl game was played in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
And it was played between two teams. One was from Texas.
Right.
The other was from Wisconsin.
Okay.
And if you can give me any one of those teams' names, you will win the whatever we have.
the tickets, the calendar,
yes,
the CD.
The calendar and the CD.
So tell us either of the two teams.
Uh-huh. One was from Texas. One was from Wisconsin.
That played in the first ever Cotton Bowl in 1937.
Correct.
800-522-5823. That's
1-800-522-KUAF.
Good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 5th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of Stella Gibbons, London, 1902. She wrote a parody of romance novels that became her first and most famous novel, Cold Comfort Farm, came out in 1932. It's the birthday of the poet W.D. Snodgrass, Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, 1926. He studied writing at the University of Iowa. He said, "I wanted to write plays, but my plays were lousy. The only way they could have gotten worse was for me to do what my teacher was telling me." His first book of poems was Heart's Needle, 1959, dealt with the pain of his divorce, the loss of his daughter through the breakup. He showed his poems first to his teacher, Robert Lowell, who said, "You've got a brain, you can't write this kind of tear-jerking stuff." But Lowell later changed his mind about that. It's the birthday of the author Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, born James Ngugi in Limuru, Kenya, in 1938. In 1964, he published the first East African novel written in English, Weep Not, Child, based on his family's troubles during the Mau Mau uprising. There followed two other novels, The River Between and A Grain of Wheat, and around that time he renounced any ties to the old colonial days and changed his name to reflect his Kikuyu heritage and became Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. And he stopped writing in English. He wrote a political play, was sent to prison for it in 1977, and while he was in prison, he wrote Devil on the Cross, the first novel in the Kikuyu language. Wrote it on toilet paper because he was denied writing paper. His most recent book, Dreams in a Time of War, a memoir of his childhood. And it's the birthday of Umberto Eco, born in the Piedmont region of Italy, 1932, philosopher, medievalist, and best-selling novelist. His book, The Name of the Rose, was a big bestseller in 1983, as was Foucault's Pendulum. Eco once explained his productivity, saying, "There's a lot of space between atom and electron and electron, and if we reduce the matter of the universe by eliminating all the space in between, the entire universe would be compressed into a ball. Our lives are full of interstices. I can work in the toilet, in the train. While swimming, I produce a lot of things, especially in the sea, less so in the bathtub, but there too." Here's a poem for today by Naomi Shihab Nye entitled Shoulders. A man crosses the street in rain, stepping gently, looking two times north and south, because his son is asleep on his shoulder. No car must splash him, no car drive too near to his shadow. This man carries the world's most sensitive cargo, but he's not marked. Nowhere does his jacket say fragile, handle with care. His ear fills up with breathing. He hears the hum of a boy's dream deep inside him. We're not going to be able to live in this world if we're not willing to do what he's doing with one another. The road will only be wide. The rain will never stop falling. Shoulders, a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, from Red Suitcase, published by Boa Editions Limited and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time now for the answer to our question.
And we asked you about, you know, if you could name any one of the teams that played in the first ever Cotton Bowl in 1937, you'd receive a pair of movie passes.
To any Malco Theater in the area.
A Tim Ernst calendar.
For 2012.
And a CD from the Fort Smith Symphony.
Right.
Okay. And the correct answer could be either Texas Christian University or Marquette University from Wisconsin.
Right. Marquette, well-known for their basketball program. Mm-hmm. Football team actually has not existed since 1960.
That's very interesting.
Yes. They were quite successful in the 20s, 30s, 40s, early 50s, but then started not being quite so successful. In fact, in 53 and 54, back-to-back winless seasons. They were known as the Golden Avalanche.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So there you go.
Interesting.
All right.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, Berryville, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas.
Have you had a chance to visit Berryville yet?
Nope.
Pleasant town.
We should go. Field trip.
There
Yay.
You go. Do a whole Berryville show sometime.
That would be nice.
All right. Maybe Berryville Green Forest, because they're high school rivals, so we'd give equal time.
Okay.
Once again, I want to thank folks at Ashley Garcia, the principal, and other folks at Washington Elementary School in Fayetteville. Tomorrow I will be moderating, asking the questions at the spelling bee there.
So let me ask you this question.
Okay.
How good were you at spelling?
Not very good. In fact, in fifth grade, you've asked, I was in the Nelson Wilkes Elementary spelling bee in Mountain Home.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 30 of us that had made good enough. I don't know how we were picked to be the 30 on stage, and I was the first one eliminated. So there you go.
What was the word? Do you remember the word?
I have no idea.
Which is the most difficult word you've spelled in your life?
I don't know, because there are certain words that I still have problems with. You know, they're just for some reason they stick in your head, and it's like, now is it spelled that way or that way?
An example.
I still, if put on the spot right now, I could not tell you the proper way to spell obstacle.
Really?
I have to look that one up every time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did you get confused in the A?
After B. I had a boss who could never remember if sheriff had one F or two. And he would say, okay, this is the time I remember. So just those little mental blocks. But no, I am still not what you would consider a very good speller, but my best friend is the dictionary. How about you?
Okay.
You a good speller?
Yes.
English?
If I can toot my own horn. Yes.
Your second language, even.
Yes.
Very good.
But I don't know. Yes.
And then Sunday afternoon, I'll be at 2 o'clock, Fayetteville Public Library.
Uh-huh.
Discussion about Pancho Sanchez, part of the Creative Conversations before the 10x10s.
Should be fun.
Should be a lot of fun. Drums will be involved. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm at the Igni Host Stream with Holkar.
Have a fantastic Thursday.